Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is September 23rd, 2021. This panel has five matters on its oral argument calendar. This is the fourth matter on our calendar. We've just taken a short break and we're ready to resume. So I will ask the marshal to call the fourth case.
Now calling case 820-1641, State of Minnesota versus Thomas Eric Walbridge.
All right, and I see counsel are here and present. I know that your connections have been checked. We are proceeding today by a video conferencing Zoom in conducting these proceedings. But in all other respects, this case is being handled according to the same proceedings we always use in the courtroom. And so we will expect you to follow those. I'll give you just a couple of quick reminders. First of all, please identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you start your remarks. And then please keep an eye on the clock. It should be visible on your screen, 15 minutes for each of you, 5-minute rebuttal for appellant. We very much look forward to the conversation with you today. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Grant Stephen Gibo. I am a special assistant state public defender appearing today on behalf of the appellant in this case, Thomas Eric Walbridge. Your Honor, there are two main issues I'm looking forward to discussing with the court today with respect to this case. The first of which is the trial court's error below in determining that reasonable suspicion existed to expand the routine traffic stop of my client, Mr. Walbridge, to include a canine sniff search of his vehicle. As I will discuss, the trial court erred in determining that the officer had a reasonable articulable suspicion that specific criminal activity was afoot, which justified that expansion of the routine stop. The second topic I'd like to discuss is the trial court's error in finding that a subsequent canine search of the interior of his vehicle was constitutional when the canine unit's entry into said vehicle was facilitated by his handling officer, allowing the dog to go into an area where the officers themselves did not have the constitutional prerogative at the time to enter. So turning to the first topic, the stop and subsequent expansion, my client was pulled over for going 5 miles over the speed limit. Officers stopped him. We don't contest that they had the ability to stop him based on their observation that he was speeding. But the constitutional malady that starts to occur is that all of the factors which the state and then the district court below points to, which justified the subsequent expansion of the search to include a dog sniff, were all based on indicia that my client was intoxicated at the time. Now, the issue that arises here is statements which were made by the arresting officer, which said that, you know, if my client would allow the consent for the search of his vehicle, he would have been free to go if drugs weren't found. He didn't consent to a search, which is his right. But the issue here is that all of the facts that the court points or that the trial court and the state points to, which justified the expansion, were all based on supposed intoxication. It was based upon his reaction time to a 30-second test. It was based upon his lack of control over his body. And then, Judge Larkin, I see your hand.
And my question first is, isn't suspicion that a person is under the influence of narcotics or some other illegal substance a basis for a dog sniff? Doesn't Wiegand say that?
No, Your Honor, I don't necessarily think that's the case, solely because the question is whether or not there could be drugs in the vehicle, which could
You know, that is a point you make repeatedly in your brief. But that's not the language that the Supreme Court used. The Supreme Court said you can't do a dog sniff unless there's reasonable articulable suspicion of drug-related criminal activity. It doesn't say drugs in the vehicle. It simply says drug-related criminal activity. And one of the reasons the Supreme Court said there wasn't such suspicion in Wiegand was because the officer did not conclude at any point that the driver was under the influence of anything, you know, suggesting that being under the influence would give cause to reasonable suspicion for a dog sniff. Indeed, the Supreme Court said, we stress that the officer testified he did not suspect appellants were under the influence of anything. doesn't that indicate that suspicion that the driver is under the influence gives rise to reasonable suspicion?
Your Honor, I'll review the Wiegelin decision more closely for rebuttal, but based on my current understanding of it, I think that that is an important distinction. And solely because the reason that my client was stopped here was based on a suspicion that he was under the influence. That's the whole reason that he was stopped. With Wiegelin, if that's not present, then the reason the officer would conduct the search would be based on a suspicion that he would find narcotics in the car. But those factors aren't present here because nothing was pointed to which would give an officer sort of the suspicion that they would find drugs if they conducted that subsequent search. And this is a separate issue from the other point that's raised by Wiegelin, and that's, you know, the officer's facilitation of the canine unit's entry into the car is a separate, you know, issue that makes that search unconstitutional.
Well, I guess I'm having trouble with a few of your points. The first point that I question is your assertion that you must have reasonable, articulable suspicion that there are drugs in the car to do a dog sniff. Wiegelin seems to say you just need reasonable, articulable suspicion of drug-related activity. Your next point seems to be suspicion that someone's under the influence of drugs doesn't get you reasonable, articulable suspicion for a dog sniff. Wiegelin twice says, you know, we stress there was no suspicion that the driver was under the influence of drugs, therefore no reasonable articulable suspicion, which leads sort of to the obvious conclusion that the Supreme Court at least thinks that suspicion that a driver is under the influence of narcotics does give rise to reasonable articulable suspicion of drug-related activity and a basis for a dog sniff. And then, you know, before we get to did the officers facilitate entry by the dog into the vehicle, you know, my read of the case law and preparing for this case says if there's reasonable articulable suspicion, you do a dog sniff and the dog alerts to the presence of narcotics outside of the car, that results in probable cause to search the car. So, I mean, I think one thing we need to talk about today is to what extent did the dog alert outside of the car, and what does the record show us about that alert? And, you know, if the record indicates that the dog alerted and an officer testified that based on what the dog did outside of the car, they considered it an alert to the presence of narcotics in the car, I don't know that it matters how the dog subsequently got in the car to ultimately find the drugs.
So let's turn to the timeline of the dog sniff, because I think that that is a relevant consideration, right? So Officer Burden, canine units, name is Bongo, they're going around the car. As they're continuing to go around the car, the dog starts to sniff heavily outside the window of the vehicle. That's undisputed. It's in the factual record. But then is the events that happen is he jumps into the car.
Okay. Before he jumps in, let me stop you there. Yeah. What does the record tell us about the meaning of the heavy sniffing outside of the car? I mean, did the handler and officer testify, well, that behavior is an alert to the presence of narcotics? Is there anything like that in the record or no?
There is, Your Honor. He says that that's a potential sign that there are narcotics in the car. However, he also states that, you know, the canine officer does not give a final alert or a final response in bracket until he gets into the backseat and finds the backpack where narcotics were found.
Let me ask you this question then, and I don't mean to hammer you, but these are interesting issues, and I've read the case law, so I have lots of questions.
Yep.
And as I read the case law, I don't see any distinction between an alert and a final alert or bracketing. The case law just talks about the dog alerting, and you seem to be saying, well, you don't have probable cause until you get a final alert. And is that anywhere in case law a distinction about different types of alerts or the type of alert that's necessary before we have probable cause?
So I'm not aware of any Minnesota case law that has a distinction. One of the cases we cited out of the Sixth Circuit, United States v. Sharp, talks about the presence of a final alert. But you're correct that I'm not aware of any Minnesota decisions that create that distinction. But that being said, I think it raises a separate question, which is if, you know, the canine unit alerted outside of the vehicle, why did the search continue at that point anyway, allowing him to enter the vehicle, right? Like if the officer at the time knew that, you know, he had probable cause to search the vehicle, why did the search continue and why did it continue for such a period allowing the officer to, you know, enter?
I'm glad you raised that question because it brings up another concern I have about your argument. much of your argument kind of goes to, well, why did the officer do this? What did the officer know? It's these decisions that we have to make de novo about reasonable articulable suspicion and probable cause are based on an objective standard. In other words, it's not, well, what did this officer think? What did this officer believe? It's what would a reasonable person have thought under the circumstances? So, I mean, to say, well, if the officer thought the dog had alerted and there was probable cause, why did he follow through with allowing the dog in the car? That's not really the question for us. The question is, well, at that point in time, would a reasonable person have a good faith and strong belief that there might be drugs in the car? And it's objective, not subjective.
I understand that. And then Judge Jensen, that I see your, or Justin, that I see your hand. I'm sorry.
I don't want to talk. Don't want to interrupt you being able to answer Judge
Larkin's question. I can address Judge Larkin's question first. I'm sorry. So, you know, I think that if, you know, the Fourth Amendment and the Minnesota Constitution, you know, Article 1, Section 10 are to have any teeth, we have to understand where that line is going to be drawn. And here there was a clear facilitation of entry into the vehicle. You know, that's unconstitutional based on the cases that we've cited. You know, it's not been decided directly in Minnesota, but the federal case law and the, you know, foreign case law is clear on that.
Look, and I'll tell you that if the facts were before us were that they showed up with the dog walked around the car, did nothing that the officers would characterize as an alert, and the dog jumped into the car, I think the state has a big problem. But here we have the dog's behavior changing and an officer saying, well, we took that as an alert to the presence of drugs. So I appreciate the concern you're raising about dogs jumping into cars without justification or with facilitation worse yet, but we have to decide this case on the facts we have. And the facts here seem to be that the dog's behavior did change in a way that the handler interpreted as an alert, and the district court credited that testimony and found that there was an alert outside the car. So we don't have a situation where police are just allowing dogs into cars, which I agree with you would be very problematic.
And Your Honor, I guess disagree with the objective basis that would constitute an alert to give probable cause to search, solely because the officer, you know, again, it's subjective, but the officer continued the search to allow the canine to enter the car. Right. We don't know definitively if drugs would have been found or if they would have searched the car had the animal not entered. And I think that's the important distinction.
But under our analysis, we have to ask, given this record, that there's what the handler termed to be an alert outside of the car, did that give rise to probable cause? If so, the officers could have gone directly into the car. It doesn't matter that they didn't. It doesn't matter that they thought they didn't have enough. It's whether we think de novo that they had enough to go into the car at that point. Because at that point, it doesn't matter if they went in or the dog went in, if there's either probable cause or there's not. So that's where I'm trying to focus.
I understand that. Yeah. And I, you know, it's undeniable in the record that there was a, you know, a heavy breathing before. And if that's something that the officer testified was sufficient, you know, then it's a call by the court whether or not that's a sufficient basis based on their de novo review to allow the full search of the interior of the car with the heightened privacy rights that go along with it.
Okay. So if I can just jump in here,
please.
Let me step back. So your argument seems to be, okay, first of all, we need to see if there's enough that's established reasonable suspicion before the dog sniff, the dog's brought out, and then was there enough of what the dog sniff found to establish probable cause? But wouldn't we, when we look to say objectively, was probable cause established before the dog jumped into the car, wouldn't we look not only to, okay, there was heavy breathing by the dog and some testimony about what that meant, you know, maybe an odor of drugs, plus don't we think go back and look at the, you know, nervousness and signs of impairment and the air fresheners and all the rest of it to look at whether objectively there's probable cause?
So, Your Honor, I would agree with that. You know, it's a totality determination, certainly. But again, you know, if we look at the totality of the facts, the fact that we need to keep in mind is the fact that the officer stated that if the search didn't come up with anything, he would have been free to leave. And the reason that, you know, we feel that that's an important distinction is that, you know, all of the indicia that he's intoxicated.
I guess I'm saying that we look at all of that indicia at that point, plus the fact that there's heavy breathing by the dog, which may indicate that the drugs are nearby, right?
Yep. And those factors, either in their totality or collectively, you know, we do not believe give rise to probable cause to search the interior of the vehicle. The key is the expansion of the search to include the dog. And we don't believe that the search conducted by the dog was constitutionally sufficient to give probable cause to enter because of the facilitation of entry. Now, that's again based on our argument that the sniffing on the outside of the car was not enough to get the officers on the inside of the car. And our, you know, line of reasoning on that is the search continued, right? The dog jumped in, the entry was facilitated and went into the back seat. But 100%, you know, you're certainly correct that it's a totality analysis to establish probable cause. But based on the facts presented to the trial court, it wasn't there. We don't believe under the court's de novo review now of these issues that it's sufficient. And as a result, we asked, because all parties agreed that this issue was determinative on appellant's arrest, that his conviction be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So we've reset the clock to 15 minutes, and counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Erica Major. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in today's matter. There are three issues that I want to address today with this court. The first is whether Deputy Armstrong had reasonable, articulable suspicion to expand the stop from the speeding investigation into DWI and a dog sniff. The second is the district court's finding whether Deputy Armstrong had probable cause to search the vehicle prior to the dog's entry into the vehicle. And the third is whether, if this court finds that there was not probable cause to search the vehicle prior to the dog's entry, whether that dog's entry in fact violated the Fourth Amendment by that instinctive jump into the open vehicle. So looking first at the question of reasonable, articulable suspicion, Your Honors, I think there are a number of facts that indicate here there was plenty of reasons why Deputy Armstrong suspected that there may be drugs present in the vehicle. And it does largely come down to his suspicion that the driver was impaired at the time he was speaking with him. He noted that there was extreme anxiety, that he was trembling, shaking profusely. There was constricted pupils. His body was so sweaty that he actually had wet hair, despite the fact that it was 55 degrees out. There was a fact that there was travel from a known drug connection, a residence that was familiar to law enforcement as being a place of controlled substance use and distribution, and multiple air fresheners present in the vehicle. Reasonable articulable suspicion is a very low.
So, counsel, if I can just ask one other question, and let me know if I'm mistaken, there were some inconsistent answers as well on Matthews. Is that right? By the appellant?
Correct. He initially stated he had never used methamphetamine and then changed that to say he had several years ago. That was also something that was taken into consideration. So looking at all of these factors, there was certainly enough at least for Deputy Armstrong to be concerned enough that he actually asked appellant to perform some field sobriety tests. So to have that then based when those field sobriety test results come in as well, he's got his sped up internal clock. He's got the eyelid flutter. There's burns on his tongue indicating recent controlled substance use. All of that together is certainly reasonable, articulable suspicion that there may be controlled substances present in the vehicle. And in fact, Your Honor, turning to the second issue, I would submit that that's actually probable cause. Even without the dog arriving on scene yet, I think at that point, this court could make a finding that probable cause exists. The connection between there being controlled substances potentially in the driver's system and potentially in the vehicle based on the multiple air fresheners being present and the transit.
Counsel, what do you think your best legal authority is for that?
For there being probable
cause? The last point you made, that it would be probable cause to enter the vehicle at that point?
Just the totality of the circumstances that there has been recent use and that this vehicle in particular is associated, given the presence of the air fresheners.
I guess what I'm looking for is a Supreme Court case. As Judge Larkin talked about quite a bit with the counsel for appellant, the Wiegand case doesn't seem to go that far. So what are you relying on? And then we'll hear from Judge Larkin. I'm sure she's got some questions. Do you have a different case? That's my simple question.
I don't, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
No, and my question was along that line. I mean, your brief heavily argues, well, there was probable cause after the field sobriety test, there was probable cause to arrest him for driving while impaired. I agree. Case law is clear on that. I'm not aware. You seem to make the leap that if there's probable cause to arrest for driving while impaired, there's probable cause to search the car. I'm not aware of any case that says that. So, I mean, do you have a case that says that? Because it used to be search incident to arrest, but we can't search incident to arrest anymore going to the automobile. So I'm not understanding how probable cause to arrest gets you to probable cause for the search.
Right. Your Honor, my reasoning on that is because this is a DWI involving controlled substance use. And when we look at, for example, a DWI by alcohol, someone could easily go to a bar somewhere, they consume alcohol, they get in the car and drive. It's not necessarily a natural inference that because they're impaired by alcohol, there's going to be alcohol in the car. I think that's different when we look at controlled substances.
Why is that? Why don't people use controlled substances with their pals, like the house he was coming from, hop in the car and drive away? Where in the case law do we find sort of an assumption that, well, we're not going to assume there's alcohol in the car unless we see open bottles through the window. But if it's narcotics, we're going to assume there's narcotics in the car.
Your Honor, because we're looking for any type of contraband, which would include something like a pipe, it would include baggies with residue, it would include the actual substance itself. Someone is more likely to have that on their person or in their vehicle than an alcohol user.
But you agree there's no law supporting that position?
Okay. Yes. I do. Your Honor, then we're also looking at the question of when the dog arrived on scene, if there isn't probable cause at that stage, when the dog arrives on scene and he begins his initial search of his sniff around the vehicle, do we have probable cause at that point? And I think the record that we have here regarding the dog's actions, it is fairly clear that there was a distinct change in behavior when that sniff began and he reaches the open window. There's testimony from Deputy Burton. The behavior changed when he got to the open window portion. His breathing became more intense. There's very heavy sniffing. He actually puts his paws up on the windowsill and stays there for a moment prior to leaping into the vehicle. So prior to that entry where he's going into the vehicle, we still have at that point what Deputy Burton interpreted as a very clear alert. It wasn't a final.
And did the deputy testify to that? Did he say, okay, here's what I observed, and based on my training and experience and work with this dog, that's an alert?
Yes. And I can refer the court to the transcript on volume two, pages 8 and 9 go into the behavior that he observed from the dog and why that was significant to him. So the fact that there was that very distinct change in behavior at the time he gets to the open window portion prior to the entry, at that point, he's indicated he's in odor. He's detected a scent of controlled substances present in the vehicle. There's reason for Deputy Burton at that point to believe that there's something inside the car. I think the fact that the dog was actually compelled by the strength of the odor to actually go into the car, that's not typical behavior that we see. This was a significant odor. The amount of drugs that were later recovered, I think, demonstrates that. That was a very, very strong odor that drew him into the vehicle. So when he's conducting that initial sniff around, at that stage, he's responding very, very aggressively to that scent. The fact that he hasn't done a bracket because he hasn't indicated the final source yet, I think it's still significant, and it's enough for, at that point, there to be probable cause for the officers to go in and search the vehicle. So that is essentially what my argument is. In regards to the entry itself, turn to the third issue. If the court doesn't find that constitutes probable cause regarding Bongo's actions, the federal case law that's outlined actually quite well in appellant's brief is essentially united. It's a dog's instinctive jump into a car does not violate the Fourth Amendment as long as that dog is entering the vehicle on his own initiative and he's not encouraged or placed into the vehicle by law enforcement. There's a good distinction that's drawn by the Hutchinson case that talks about a dog leaping in because he's drawn in by the strength of the odor versus law enforcement opening doors or trying to somehow manipulate the car to amplify the odor.
Isn't there an argument by appellant that the officer did open the door eventually for the dog? Like the dog went in, came out, and then opened the door? Is that clear from the record?
That is, I don't know that it rises to a factual dispute, but it is a concern because the video in this case was profoundly blurry. It went in and out of focus, and it's extremely difficult. The transcript shows as they're attempting to review the body cam on the stand, it's very hard to see what happened. So we are relying on Deputy Burton's testimony primarily regarding what happened there. Looking at the video at around 44.01 on the timestamp, I'm looking at it. I see Bongo, and Deputy Burton saw as well, Bongo jumps in first. There's a long pause where Deputy Burton is watching intently with a flashlight. He's on the outside looking in through the window with that flashlight, trying to see where Bongo is going. Bongo jumps back out, and it's at that point that the door opens and Deputy Burton goes in. So because that alert has been completed at that point, by the time Bongo jumps back out of the vehicle, I don't know that there is, I don't know that there's contradictory evidence to that. The video shows what it shows.
It's clear the officer opened the door. What's not necessarily clear is whether he opened the door before or after the final alert.
That would be correct. Yes, it is after the dog went in and the dog came back out. Yes. And the testimony,
the officer opened the door. Did the dog go back into the car?
Yes.
Okay.
For a second time. Yes.
So just to follow up, when did the dog make the final alert? Was it after that? I mean, according to the deputy's testimony, I appreciate we don't have a great camera.
Right. The deputy, I think, he was indicating the final alert was to the backpack, which was inside the vehicle. So
before, after the door opened.
And I don't know that we have that clarified, unfortunately. Your Honors, again, I would submit whether or not the final alert took place, I don't think is the relevant or the most important inquiry here. I think the fact that there was that initial alert that was a profound change in behavior, the odor that he detected was so intense that it actually caused him on his own initiative to leap into the vehicle. I think there's, at that point, it's very clear that an odor has been detected. There's something present in that car that is alerting the dog's senses and causing him to behave that way. So the court should find that there was probable cause at that point to commence the search of the vehicle. Whether Deputy Burton and Deputy Armstrong began that search pursuant to the final alert where he bracketed and confirmed it was the backpack, or whether it was just on that initial notice that there was controlled substances present within the vehicle, I don't think makes a difference. I think that initial alert at the windowsill is the tipping point. Your Honor, I don't know that there's anything else that I wish to add on this unless the court has further questions. I would waive my remaining time.
Looks like the panel does not have any questions for you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank
you. So the clock has been reset, and we're ready to hear from counsel for appellant. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So briefly, I would direct the court to the September 4th, 2019 transcript at pages 9 through 10. That's where the officer lays out the timeline of what happened. Just to clarify the record, the final bracket on the backpack did not occur. The entry into the back seat did not occur until the entry to the vehicle was facilitated by the handler, until the door was open and then he went into the back seat. And that's paramount to us. You know, I'll concede case law is uniform. If the officer facilitates the entry, constitutional violation. If the officer does not facilitate the entry, no constitutional violation. But here, the final bracket did not occur until after that final entry arose. The state's argument, appears to draw a distinction between the constitutional rights against unreasonable search and seizure for a drug user compared to, someone who uses a legal substance like alcohol. You know, obviously, we don't believe that that's the case. Everyone has the same rights under the Constitution to not have searches unless the requisite standards are met. So here, the expansion.
Well, counsel, what I didn't hear you respond to, but I could have missed it at the beginning of your remarks. So what I hear counsel for respondent arguing is that the expansion of the stop, so going back to your very first issue, that was based on a totality of the circumstances and not mere indicia of impairment. And so would you respond to that?
I would, Your Honor. So the state points to several facts about, that justify the search based on impairment of the driver, right? They go to great length to talk about burns on the tongue, slowed reaction speed, all of that. And when we're analyzing these indicia of impairment and whether this gives us the requisite standard to expand the search, you also have to look at the fact that if the search would have not brought up anything, he would have been free to go, if you would have consented to a search, the arresting officer in this case said, if you consent to the search and we don't find drugs, you're going to be free to go. And that, as a factual and legal matter, undercuts their argument that there was reasonable suspicion based on impairment. Because, you know, it's incredible to me that all of these facts are going to show that he was high and couldn't, you know, safely operate his vehicle, but yet he was never read his implied consent warning. He was never placed under arrest for any driving, you know, while impaired. And if there, he would have consented to the search, he would have been allowed to leave. And that shows me that the basis that the officer used and the basis that we should be looking at is not whether or not there would be drugs in the vehicle, but whether or not he had signs of impairment which justified the search. And that's simply not the case. There are other decisions cited in our brief. State v. Lugo is an example where the officers saw a suspect, you know, leave a park, and there were all of these facts that led them to believe that there were going to be drugs found in the car, right? He met with like a shady teenager in a parking lot. He picked some stuff up and then he left. Here, we don't have those facts. We know that there were signs of impairment. We know that he left the house of a, you know, quote unquote, known drug user. Those all definitely lead to a suspicion that he's under the influence, but that suspicion is necessarily undercut by the officer's subsequent statement that you would have been free to go if there was nothing in the car. If he was really concerned that my client was impaired and couldn't safely drive, he would have arrested him for that at that moment, but instead they went on a wild goose chase to look in the car. That's what the Constitution protects against, is these unreasonable expansions to go to places where you have an expectation of privacy. And that's the reason that we're here today. That's the issue. If your honors have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them with the balance of my time. But otherwise, you know, thank you all for doing this. Hopefully by the next time we have a case, it'll be back in person, not all zoomed up. But.
We definitely agree with your last statement, counsel. For appellant, we would all like to return to in person as well. But we're grateful that we are able to hear from you today. It doesn't look like the panel has any additional questions, so I think that we can safely say then that this matter is submitted.